Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Great. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled Political Speech of Retired Admirals and Generals. Our moderator today is Andrew Darlington. Andrew is currently the director of the Florida Office of Election Crimes and Security. He graduated the U.S. Naval Academy and was commissioned in the United States Marine Corps. He deployed twice to Afghanistan as an infantry officer. For his actions, he was awarded the Purple Heart and other personal combat awards. He joined the Florida Department of State in 2022 and was appointed in his current role in March 2023. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expression and opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Caroline. We've seen a shocking increase in the use of political speech by generals and admirals in the last three presidential elections. Most recently, Kamala Harris relied on this during her only debate appearance. In response to these headlines and more, there have been growing calls for accountability. This webinar will provide an analysis of legal issues in these uncharted waters. What constitutes prohibited speech by retired generals and admirals? What might be protected under the First Amendment? What other constitutional considerations exist if a prosecution in a court-martial were to be considered? What trial considerations exist? Here to help us navigate these uncharted waters are three distinguished panelists. First, Julian Dan McCarthy has had a distinguished career in both military and civilian legal service. He graduated from the United States Naval Academy in 1977 and served as a surface warfare officer aboard the USS Dale from 1977 to 1980. Following his military service at sea, he pursued legal studies, earning his JD with honors from Duke University in 1983. Captain McCarthy began his legal career as trial counsel at the Naval Legal Service Office in Jacksonville. He then served as staff judge advocate in Subic Bay. For 6 years, he was the senior uniformed legal advisor to the Secretary of the Navy. Next, Professor Domino teaches courses related to constitutional law, election law, federal courts, statutory interpretation, and criminal law. Professor Domino graduated summa cum laude from the State University of New York at Buffalo in 1998. He then attended Harvard Law School, where he was articles editor of the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, from which he graduated cum laude in 2001. Professor Domino served as chief clerk to Associate Judge Albert Rosenblatt of the New York State Court of Appeals, and then clerked for Senior Circuit Judge Lawrence A. Silberman of the United States Court of Appeals for the District for the D.C. Circuit, and also Judge Paul L. Freeman of the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. And finally, Robert Leiter is an associate professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School, George Mason University. His scholarly interests are in criminal law, criminal procedure, and constitutional law, especially concerning questions about the use of force and the rule of law. He has written on the law of self-defense, the constitutional allocation of military powder, and gun control. Among other places, he has published in the Florida Law Review, which is forthcoming, the Indiana Law Journal, and the Wall Street Journal. Before teaching, Professor Leiter worked in private practice for a number of years. He clerked for Judge Diane S. Sykes of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, and also Justice Clarence Thomas. Professor Leiter earned a BA summa cum laude from the George Washington University and a JD from Yale Law School, and finally a PhD in philosophy. And his dissertation was defended with distinction from Georgetown. While at Yale Law, he served as an articles editor for the Yale Law Journal. At this time, I'll turn it over to Captain Dan McCarthy.
Thank you, Andrew, and good afternoon to everybody that's listening. I certainly think you've picked an appropriate topic for these times. As I was preparing for this, I found articles from Jonathan Turley, from Victor Davis Hanson, a Harvard Law Review article which addressed, can military officers be returned to active duty and tried by courts-martial? I'm going to try to keep my comments sort of in a streamlined approach so that we don't get lost in the weeds, because there's a lot of different questions here. And as you will see as I go through this, there's not a lot of precedent for the return of senior military officers for either disciplinary or administrative proceedings for violations of the UCMJ. It starts, of course, with the UCMJ, which is basically the foundational rules for the military justice system. All of us that come into the military learn very quickly that we are subject to the UCMJ, and the statute itself says that active duty, reserve, service academy students and ROT students, and retired are subject to the code, provided they are drawing pay. So we begin with the UCMJ applies to military officers. It applies when you're wearing a uniform, and it applies after your retirement. I am still subject to the UCMJ, and I understand and know that. In pursuing this, I also, you need to know there are some distinctions in how the reach of the UCMJ affects various people that wear a uniform. Enlisted personnel in the Navy and the Marine Corps, after they do their service for 10 years, they are in something called the Fleet Reserve. And during that time, the statute specifically says they can be returned to active duty and are subject to the UCMJ. Other enlisted personnel in the Army and Air Force are not subject. So on the enlisted side, Navy and Marines for 10 years after their service are subject to the UCMJ. On the officer side, it's for life. Military officers are subject to the UCMJ and have been made to know that. Next, I wanted to move to, so if we accept that we're subject to the UCMJ, what specific provisions of the UCMJ might reach speech or various forms of expression? There are a handful, and I will just show you real quick. Again, I don't want to waste time, but I also want you to have a kind of clear how it works. When you're on active duty, there is a DOD directive which addresses almost all forms of political activity. It tells you whether you can have a bumper sticker. It tells you whether you can donate money to a political group. It tells you whether you can write a letter to the editor, things like that. And the answer to those is you can do all of those things. The specific purpose is to allow you to execute the role as a citizen in the United States despite your military service. There then is a second section which tells you what you cannot do. And the biggest function or biggest concern of that section is that you don't ever appear to be talking on behalf of the military. If I provide somebody a political opinion, it needs to be quite clear that it's a personal opinion. I shouldn't do it while in uniform. I should maintain sort of a private capacity if I want to participate in political activities, so as not to confuse somebody that my unit thinks X, or that my service thinks X, or that everybody in the military has a certain opinion, because it's certainly not true. It's a very diverse opinion. So on active duty, you worry about the DOD directive, and you can almost go to the very paragraph of whatever it is you want to know. Can I put a big sign on top of my car for a particular candidate, or things of that nature? I just want you to know that those things are solved. In my 30 years of service, I never worried, was I inside or outside the line? I always knew how I could get an answer to that. We also vote when we're overseas. For instance, I served in the Philippines for 4 years, and I was the voting officer. And in my capacity, I went around to everybody and made sure that they had a ballot and that all were properly submitted. So we do engage in political activity, but we do it in a personal capacity, and you do it to try to make sure you're not adversely influencing others. One of the first rules of the Navy that I learned as an ensign reporting to my ship was there's two things we don't talk about: religion and politics. So kind of from the start, you're schooled in keep it to yourself. You can be a citizen, but don't pretend to be speaking on behalf of the military. Moving past that now, after you retire, then it becomes, okay, what provisions of the UCMJ actually would impose some restriction? And I'm going to tell you about four very quickly, because again, I don't want to get bogged down. But the first is contemptuous speech. Article 88 of the UCMJ says that you cannot use words against the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, members of Congress, governors, things of that nature. It doesn't really define contemptuous speech, but I think most of us know it would be some kind of prejudicial or damaging comment made on to or on, about somebody very senior in our chain of command, specifically president, vice president, secretary of defense, secretary of a military department, those kinds of things. That's Article 88. There are a couple other articles that would impose some restriction on speech. One is Article 104, aiding the enemy. And it specifically says that you cannot aid the enemy in any way. And it even leaves a sort of catch-all category called other things. You can't do things that would assist the enemy with arms, with intelligence, with things of that nature, or other things. So aiding the enemy, and it carries a death penalty potentially if you were ever to be court-martialed for that. Article 84, mutiny or sedition. It says that you cannot usurp or override military authority or pretend to speak on behalf of somebody senior to you in a conflicting way, as if you were speaking with authority. So that would limit it. Espionage. You cannot speak and provide intelligence that you might be aware of because of your position. Both mutiny and espionage carry a potential death sentence. Interestingly, the UCMJ does not have a treason provision. So when you hear people say, and I've seen a million different letters to the editor, and that so-and-so should be charged with treason and returned to the military, recalled to the military for court-martial, there is no treason statute in the UCMJ. Just a little note. The punishments for all the crimes in the UCMJ are listed, and they change. And we just had a recent modification of some of the punishments. But leaving the UCMJ section, remember, it applies to officers. You can't use contemptuous language once you're retired toward our senior leadership. And you also, if you get beyond that and get into the much more prejudicial things like aiding the enemy or espionage or mutiny or sedition, your speech can be limited by what you say or do. Well, let's move past that then to, in the event that I'm retired and I violate the contemptuous words provision or any of the others that I've mentioned, as some people are alleging that some of our senior leaders have done, as Andrew alluded to in the beginning, the question then becomes, what can you do about it? And is the military solely responsible for holding them accountable, or can the federal system or the state system get involved? I'm going to complete my comments to the Uniform Code and to the military side of it. The answer is military officers can be recalled to the Navy, to the active duty. That's 10 U.S. Code 688, and it allows for people subject to the UCMJ, if retired, can be returned. In my Navy career as a Judge Advocate General, one time we returned somebody from Guam, actually, and prosecuted him for violations that occurred after his retirement. So that's another question. Does the conduct have to be before they leave the service, or can they be returned and prosecuted after leaving the service for UCMJ violations? And the answer to that is it can occur during or after, and you can be recalled if you're subject to the UCMJ. Again, there is some dispute about some of this. I'm telling you what the existing law is. Military officers can be recalled. Then you get, okay, once I recall an officer, let's say that one of the military services wanted to do that, the service secretary would recall them to active duty, and then a disciplinary proceeding would begin. Under the UCMJ, that's usually predicated first on an investigation, followed by a court-martial. Again, it sounds pretty easy. They committed offense, recall them, court-martial them. It gets much, much harder when we talk about senior officers. Specifically, if we're in the 3- and 4-star admirals or generals, which are most likely the ones to speak in a way that might have attract attention, especially if they speak negatively about the services that they served in. Court-martialing them is very difficult for a couple reasons that I'll lay out. First off, to do the investigation, you're going to have to assign somebody in the military to do it. If it happens to be a 4-star or a 3-star, they would need to be senior. You could do it with someone junior, but it's never been done, and I would think that that's not something you'd want to do. If the investigation, let's say somehow you conduct an investigation and it concludes that there should be a trial by court-martial, now you run into, well, how do I convene that court? Can I use a judge that's significantly junior to a 3- or 4-star admiral or general? Can I use a prosecutor that's significantly junior? And the biggest drawback is if they elect members, trial by jury, in the military we call those members, they have to be senior to the accused. So if you returned a 3- or 4-star admiral or general with the idea of sending them to court-martial, you would be looking at a panel that would have to be all 4-stars or 3-stars, depending on the accused rank, senior to the accused. And that would impose significant difficulty. And as I say, it's never been done. And additionally, if it started for some of the things that we've looked at and discussed, you know, political comments, think of who your witnesses would be. It could be a former president. It could be a senator. It could be other senior military people. I just think it would get out of hand very, very quickly and be very difficult to do. So let's move on from that then to, well, what if court martials are very difficult and unlikely, what can the military do? And that becomes, there are administrative sanctions that are available. It's called an officer grade determination. And that's most likely, and that's when I look back at various cases, that's what you see. The service secretary or the secretary of defense could recall a 3- or 4-star, or he could simply order that an investigation be done about the conduct that's in question, and with a review done by the service secretary or the secretary of defense, and then a final recommendation on grade. They can be demoted to whatever star they last served satisfactorily in. So I'll kind of wind up with that. Bottom line, military officers subject to UCMJ, they can be recalled. Once recalled, there are disciplinary avenues and administrative avenues, and the most likely is the administrative avenue with a review of whatever it is that's prejudicial, and then an administrative determination by the Secretary of Defense or a service secretary as to the last grade served in satisfactorily. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Captain McCarthy. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Professor Domino to analyze some of the First Amendment considerations.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me. Thanks to my fellow panelists for being here and the audience for listening in. I thought it was kind of interesting when Captain McCarthy mentioned that the two things that he was told that not to talk about in the military were religion and politics. Well, I'm a professor of constitutional law and the First Amendment and election law, so I make a living talking about religion and politics. So my role on this panel is to give some background First Amendment law about the law that might apply to this question, the question of retired military's rights to speak. The Supreme Court has not directly addressed this question at all. The closest it's come is to address two different lines of cases relating to government employees. And so I'm going to talk about those briefly within the space of about 10 minutes and then make some conclusions about what those cases might say for retired military. The first line of cases is the Hatch Act cases, starting with a case called Mitchell back from the 40s. In Mitchell, the court upheld the Hatch Act, which imposes limitations on government employees' political activities. It prohibited government employees from taking an active part in political campaigns. And it was challenged by, among other things, an industrial worker in the United States Mint who wanted to be a ward committeeman and work the polls in Philadelphia. And he said, I'm not an IRS agent. I'm not a U.S. attorney or somebody. My political opinions don't reflect on the government because nobody knows who I am anyway. I work in the mint the same way any other kind of industrial worker works in almost anonymity. But the Supreme Court nonetheless upheld the Hatch Act and said that it was really important for the government not to be able to use government employees to create a kind of political machine and reward people for their political activities and opinions instead of for their service in their jobs. The court also said that if it were okay for these government employees to participate in politics, there would then be pressure on them to act and speak in a way that would support their superiors' political opinions, and that limiting the political activities of these employees in some way protected the rights of those employees because it protected them from that kind of pressure. Even though that's an old case, it's never been overruled. In fact, it was reaffirmed in the 70s in a case called Civil Service Commission versus Letter Carriers, where the court said that the interests that justified the court's decision in Mitchell were just as valid in the then modern era as they had been in the immediate post-New Deal period. And so the Hatch Act continues to be the law, although it has been moderated in the 90s in particular. By statute, the Hatch Act was limited and the penalties were lessened. But it's still the law and it still regulates federal employees' behavior, not federal retirees' behavior at all, but active government workers. The military is not covered directly by the Hatch Act, but as Captain McCarthy pointed out, the military is subject to restrictions which in some ways are parallel to the restrictions that the Hatch Act imposes. The second line of cases is the one starting with Pickering versus Board of Education, which many of you lawyers will have read in law school. It involves a teacher in a public school who published a letter to the editor that was critical of his own school board, and the school board imposed discipline on him, and the teacher brought the case eventually to the U.S. Supreme Court. And he said, I should have the First Amendment right to speak on these matters of public concern, like how the school board is spending money. And if the school board could limit the speech of teachers and other people who work for the school, then the negative behaviors of the school board won't come to light. That is to say, it's particularly important. It's not just okay, but especially important for government employees to be able to speak about their agencies because of the special additional inside knowledge that they have about the functioning of those agencies. And the court accepted that argument and ruled in favor of Pickering, but it did place a couple of limitations, which have then been explored in later cases, including ones that are quite modern. The Pickering case itself is from the late 60s, but the court has extended this line of cases very much up to the present. Here are the two limitations on the right that was recognized in Pickering. The court said, first, if your job is to speak on behalf of the agency, then you can be told what to say by your superiors and what not to say. And so if you have a job as, just to make the thing obvious, as a press secretary for a mayor, and the mayor tells you, I want you to say things that are put a favorable spin on my administration, and I don't want you to say things that put a negative light on it, and the press secretary goes out and publishes a letter to the editor saying how corrupt the mayor's administration is, then that person can be fired. Now, we're not talking about any kind of criminal discipline or even civil liability. We're just talking about employment-related discipline. You can lose your job, you can be demoted, that kind of thing. And the court says, well, if your job is to convey a particular message, then you can be told what that message is, and you can't deviate from it without being at risk of employment-related discipline. The second limitation was that you have to be speaking on a matter of public concern. If you're just bringing out some kind of private gripe, that's not protected by the First Amendment. And even if you're speaking on a matter of public concern, the government can limit an employee's speech if the speech interferes with the operation of the agency. That is to say, the government as an employer has the same kind of ability that other employers do, that other employers can recognize that if you're doing something, even something that's constitutionally protected in the sense that we couldn't criminally punish you for it, but you're doing something that undermines the functioning of the job, then you can suffer employment-related discipline for that. And that includes if your speech causes a conflict with other people at the office and does any number of things that interfere with the functioning of the office. But the key is that the government has to say, if it wants to impose discipline on the employee, that the employee's speech is interfering with the job responsibilities of our office. It's making it harder for us to act as a functioning employer, as to carry out our responsibilities. The government cannot just say, we don't like your speech because it's critical of us, or it takes a view that we don't want to promote. The employee has a right under Pickering to make public statements about public issues that are different from the views of the employing agency, as long as those views don't interfere with the functioning of the agency. So that's the two general areas. Now, how does this relate to the military? Well, I think it's quite clear, at least in a lot of instances, that the behaviors of active duty military would not be protected, that active duty military would not have any kind of First Amendment right to speak in a way that would as Captain McCarthy explained, would purport to represent the views of the military generally or superiors or the government or anything like that. So that, I think, is pretty darn clear. And if anything, it's more important for members of the military to be free of political pressure and free, and it's more important for them not to impose political pressure on other people than it is for regular old government employees to be free from those kinds of pressures. So I think the rules that we talked about with regard to the Hatch Act apply just as well and probably even easier with regard to active military than with other kinds of government employees. But retired military is different. that for retired military, there is much less of a government need to have the retired military support any particular kind of policy that the military wants to push. And the benefits of having speech by retired military who have a special storehouse of knowledge that they can bring to public debate on very important public issues is just as important, and again, probably more important than it is for a school teacher in the position of somebody like Pickering to bring to public debate how money is being sent by a school board. So despite the fact that, as Captain McCarthy said, there are statutes and the Uniform Code of Military Justice does purport to impose limitations on the speech of even retired military, there are legal problems as well as the practical problems that he explained in recalling and bringing up on charges retired military personnel for speaking in a way that the UCMJ purports to prohibit. So I think that the ability of one of those retired military to raise a First Amendment objection to a charge that he used contemptuous language for someone, a high-ranking political official, for example, I think that would be a really strong argument as a constitutional matter, even though it appears to be prohibited by statute and the UCMJ. So, Andrew, again, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to the questions after I hear from Professor Leiter.
Thank you so much, Professor Domino. At this time, last but not least, Professor Leiter, the digital floor is yours.
All right. Thank you very much. So Captain McCarthy talked a little bit about how the UCMJ is structured, and Professor Domino talked about the First Amendment restrictions. I want to look at some of the other restrictions in terms of the powers that Congress has to govern the land and naval forces. And the essence of my argument is that the prosecution of military retirees for conduct that occurs in their civilian life exceeds Congress's powers to regulate the armed forces under Article 1, Section 8, and runs afoul of a corresponding provision, the Fifth Amendment, that guarantees the common law modes of criminal procedure. So in Solorio versus United States, the Supreme Court held that Congress may impose military law criminal jurisdiction upon all members of the land and naval forces for any crime they commit on duty or off duty, whether or not the crime related to their military service. And for a few years prior, the court had required that the military offense of a service-related connection, but Solorio abolished the service-related connection and just said that the Constitution authorizes court-martial jurisdiction over an offense based on one factor, the military status of the accused. So that's been kind of the rule that has come out of this, that the military status of the accused is dispositive. The Supreme Court, however, has never defined what military status is dispositive to have military jurisdiction. Now, the lower courts have relied on Solorio's capacious language to uphold the broadest military jurisdiction imaginable. And most recently, in Larrabee versus Del Toro, the D.C. Circuit held, quote, that a person has military status if he has a formal relationship with the military that includes a duty to obey orders. And that case involved a member of the Fleet Marine Reserve, which is a component to which retired enlisted Marines can go upon 20 years of service before they're deemed formally retired after 30 years. And the D.C. Circuit held that Larrabee fit within its test because he had the duty to, quote, reenter active service, unquote, if ordered to do so during certain emergencies, and because he could be required to report to active duty for training for up to 2 months in any four-year period. Now, both in a symposium article that I put in the Villanova Law Review and an amicus brief that I filed in Larrabee, I argue that the extension of military jurisdiction to retirees violates the Fifth Amendment. the military, the Constitution recognizes two military statuses, not one. Those that are in the regular forces, what the Constitution refers to as the armies and navy or the land and naval forces, and second, the militia. The distinction between the regular forces, the armies and navies, and the militia, that distinction is fundamental to how the Constitution governs military affairs, including for the military justice system. The constitutional provisions guaranteeing access to civilian courts and to common law modes of proceeding in criminal trials do not apply in cases arising in the land or naval forces, nor do they apply in cases arising, quote, in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger. Properly distinguishing which individuals belong to the constitutional armies and navy and which belong to the militia is thus necessary to determine the breadth of Congress's power to subject military personnel to the military criminal justice system. And in a series of articles, today the dominant understanding is that the framers' army-militia distinction rests on federalism, that the armies are the federal land forces, while the militia is the state land force, essentially a state army. And in some recent articles, I've argued that this prevailing understanding is profoundly mistaken, that at the framing, the army-militia divide was primarily a professionalism distinction, not a federalism one. The armies were the land forces that comprise soldiers whose sole or primary occupation was war. The Navy was also a species of regular forces, and these forces stood in contrast to the militia, which consisted of the citizenry who were subject to military service on a part-time and emergency basis. Civilians primarily, soldiers on occasion, as the Supreme Court put it. And recognizing this professionalism distinction is key for understanding the proper jurisdictional boundary between military and civilian criminal justice. The existence of a separate state criminal justice system with status-based jurisdiction is appropriate for members of the land and naval forces. But that system still has to be limited to members of the land and naval forces as those terms were understood at the framing. And I think this means that status-based jurisdiction should be limited to professional soldiers, what today we would call members of the regular components of the armed forces. Yet, I think this important limitation has been mostly evaded by recent judicial decisions, with the result being the creeping expansion of the military justice system to civilian life. And in these papers, I argue that military retirees, although statutorily part of the regular forces, are actually in substance a species of militia or reservists. They are not subject to indefinite service during peace or war. They are subject to temporary service. They primarily have civilian careers. There is a limited set of reasons or a limited time by which you can recall them. For the Fleet Reserve and Fleet Marine Reserve, they are subject to up to 2 months of training as a 4 or 5 year period. It was basically part-time military training in peacetime. And the only time they're subject to indefinite service is during war or some other national emergency. So basically, we treat retirees like the framers treated the militia, where they had either no obligation in peacetime or at most a limited training regime and then indefinite service during wartime. And so I think what the Fifth Amendment was saying was that those who are on indefinite active service are subject to status-based military law at all times, but that the militia, those who are civilians primarily and soldiers on occasion, are subject to a functional military justice system. They are subject to the strictures of military justice when they are in active service, and they are treated as civilians in their civilian life. The the classification of military officers as active officers, even as they're retired, I think also creates other constitutional problems. So take, for example, the incompatibility clause. The incompatibility clause says that a person holding an office under the United States shall not be eligible to be a senator or representative during his continuation in office. Many members of Congress have been retired members of the military. If they are active officers in the Army, their service in Congress is unconstitutional, and with good reason. It gives the executive control over members of Congress, and it allows the executive branch to subject members of Congress to military discipline, which I think is quite dangerous. And I want to close here with some final thoughts on the current trajectory in military law. The expansion of the military justice system into the civilian realm is dangerous. Soldiers lack the civil liberty that civilians possess. Military members can be told what to wear, how to keep their hair, whether they can display a yarmulke. They can be imprisoned for things that would be only a civil offense or even constitutionally protected, like the subject of this forum, which is criticizing governmental leaders or disrespecting a superior or not showing up for work. These rules are antithetical to a free society, and it's one thing to impose them in a system of military law upon the military when it's needed for military necessity. It's quite another to allow this system to bleed into civilian life by imposing these rules on citizens who have some nominal affiliation with the military, but who are not in active service. And to subject reserve and retired soldiers to status-based jurisdiction is to permanently exclude them from their constitutional rights. It is to create a permanent class of military men who will never share in the rights that they protect for others, a system in which the guardians of our republic are not fully its citizens. And I think a country that splits itself into two in this manner will not have healthy civil-military relations. It will set up a system where those whose careers are spent defending a democracy permanently exists as outsiders looking in.
Well, thank you, Professor Leiter, and to the previous two as well. At this time, I'm going to turn to questions. We do have several questions from attendees, so I'll try to get to all of them. I think the first question I want to pose to all three of you, and let's go in reverse order this time with Professor Leiter first, Professor Domino second, and then finally Captain McCarthy. But we spent this panel analyzing considerations of a trial by court-martial. Now, I'm unaware of a prohibition that would prevent the Department of Defense, if they uncover evidence of a federal crime outside of the UCMJ during their current investigations. I'm unaware of a prohibition that would prevent a referral from the Department of Defense to the United States Attorney General for recommended prosecution. So I'd ask all three of you how your analysis may differ if it's still a retired general or admiral weighing in, but being tried in the appropriate federal district court for a violation of a federal criminal law. So for example, Professor Leiter, you mentioned the difference between, how you think it's prohibited to bring someone back under the Fifth Amendment at court-martial, but would there be any unique Fifth Amendment hurdle to such trial in federal district court? And to Professor Domino, I'd ask you to touch on one of your analysis points, which is undermining. You know, would there be a difference, say, in a retired general or admiral weighing in on TV about a candidate's perceived abilities to be commander-in-chief versus calling them a name or something more along those lines? So I'd ask all three of you to weigh in.
I don't see any problems at all subjecting retired members of the armed forces to the ordinary federal criminal justice system. The English legal scholar A.V. Dicey once described being in a military status as saying you have all of the rights and burdens of civilian law, plus you take on all of the rights and burdens of military law. And indeed, I think one of the ways in which England maintains civilian supremacy over the regular forces once it created them was to say that your status as a member of the army did not exempt you from ordinary civilian law, that your military duties were in addition to that, not in lieu of that. And in fact, if you look at the Declaration of Independence, one of the grievances that's laid against the crown is exempting members of the British Army from civilian law and the civilian modes of trial. Now, what we're finding, so for the most part, military retiree jurisdiction has lain fallow over our history. And I think there have been several reasons for that. One of them is there has been profound disagreement about its constitutionality. President Wilson vetoed a bill removing military retiree jurisdiction because he thought it was essential for the commander-in-chief to be able to court-martial retirees to maintain military discipline. But you get I think it was President Harding's administration, and there the president disapproved of court-martialing of a sentence in a court-martial of a military retiree because the administration was of the opinion that court-martials were for members of the active forces and that it was unconstitutional to extend the jurisdiction. And so for a large part of our history, this jurisdiction has lain fallow. What has happened recently is that there have been a lot of prosecutions of sex offenses for conduct that occurred outside the jurisdiction of the federal civilian system. And often they involve foreign countries where one American retiree attacks another American and the local country may not be interested in the case. And so there have been a fair number of prosecutions there. But the full scope of military retiree prosecution has never been acted upon and seems to be discouraged. So I don't think we will have a case where you could easily prosecute the case in the civilian justice system and they don't do it. I think the military system for retirees are going to be used in cases either that occur abroad for which there's no federal jurisdiction or for peculiar military offenses like criticizing the president and certain other government leaders. And so the question is really, what's the legitimacy of that action?
Thanks, Professor. Professor DeMena.
Thanks. From a First Amendment perspective, it's not likely that you're going to get a criminal prosecution of retired military for these kinds of statements. That is, the statements cannot be made a crime for civilians, and so you're not likely to end up in a civilian court prosecuting one of those kinds of offenses. If a person who is retired military would engage in some kind of speech-related behavior that is constitutionally unprotected and so could be the subject of a criminal prosecution, were to engage in threatening behavior or something in a way that would be subject to a criminal prosecution, then I agree with Professor Leiter that in that instance, the First Amendment would provide no barrier at all to the prosecution of that person in a civilian court.
Thank you. Captain McCarthy?
I agree with both professors. I also would point out that right now we have a 4-star Navy admiral that is pending federal court prosecution. This is for a bribery charge. So the federal system has been used for a variety of criminal cases. When you get to the speech side, as the professor has pointed out, I think the federal court probably wouldn't be interested in the case and it wouldn't offend a federal law. So it would be left to the military. And as I say, procedurally, it's so difficult to do in the military. My guess is there would be administrative sanctions possibly in the military, but that would be the extent of it.
Understood. Thank you. Next question is, can the First Amendment or a lack of jurisdiction be raised as an affirmative defense and adjudicated in the UCMJ proceeding. Either Professor Domino or Captain McCarthy, anyone feel free to weigh in.
On the military side, clearly the accused is going to use it as an affirmative defense, and I'm sure he will find good legal representation that would help him do that.
I agree. I think that there has been a controversy since 1920 on the whether a treaty could result in reducing people's constitutional rights, that is American citizens' constitutional rights. And I think most people think no, that the UCMJ would not be able to supersede any kind of First Amendment rights. So the answer to the questioner's question is yes, that you very likely would be able to use the First Amendment as a defense to a charge in this regard. Now, whether it succeeds or not was the subject of my primary remarks. And like I said, I think that the First Amendment defense, at least to some of these kinds of charges, would be quite strong.
Understood. Thank you. Next question from the attendees. Can the Secretary of Defense, in spite of the pardon recently granted to a certain general, recall him to active duty and prosecute him for those comments which appear to be treasonous? Can the commander-in-chief do the same to this certain general? What is the effect of the peremptory pardon? Anyone? Professor Leiter, do you want to start?
Sure. I think the president has power to try to convene military charges under the current statute, under both active and retired members of the armed forces, and for those who retired from a regular component, for that conduct that occurred either on duty or civilian life. Now, there's a Supreme Court case that said that once you sever all connection with the armed forces, that you can't be recalled and court-martialed, including for conduct that occurred while you were on active duty, which I think that decision, Christian Burset, who's a professor at Notre Dame, uncovered some reasoning of the case called Sackville's case, where I think the court might have gotten that wrong as an originalist matter, but that is currently the state of the law. Now, for those who are currently on active duty, sure, the president can court-martial them. Pardon, I'm not sure about. The pardon will definitely exempt him from, he could plead that as a defense for any crime that occurred within federal civilian jurisdiction. I'm not exactly sure what the effect of the pardon is offhand for criminal jurisdiction, because military discipline is not, generally speaking, a crime under the Constitution. It falls into a different category, which is why you don't get trial by jury. So I'm not sure if the pardon as it's constructed would be a defense or not. Now, I would say, too, retired members of the military, retired officers, if they don't want to be subject to court-martial jurisdiction going forward, could always resign their commissions. So you have to be a retired member of the military. You don't have to actually be receiving pay, but you do have to be eligible for pay. And so I think for officers, I'm not sure because this doesn't happen much, but I think for officers, you could resign your commission and that would be the end. Now, doing so under the old retirement system would have enormous consequences because military retirees received a pension, which was basically all the money that they had through the retirement system. Maybe you'll see more of that in the decades to follow because the military is going to a blended retirement system that is part pension, part 401k system. So the costs of foregoing one's pension by resigning may be less. But right now, I think unless the officer were independently wealthy, there's no way to exempt yourself from the justice system practically, even though you can do so lawfully by resigning.
If finally, I'll ask Professor DeMena to answer first. Do any of the laws and policies mentioned become null or suspended or otherwise change during a declaration of war or emergency?
The Supreme Court has hinted of the possibility of some special wartime powers, and some justices have made statements like that in separate opinions. But I know of no majority opinion in the Supreme Court that holds that there is any kind of additional authority of the government to limit speech in wartime. The court, including some very renowned justices, Justice Holmes in particular, has said that there are some things which may be said in peacetime that shouldn't be said in wartime, and so the government can have an easier time passing a clear and present danger test, for example, in demonstrating that somebody's speech might or would likely cause more severe problems if you disclose troop movements or caches of weapons or whatever. So the government would have an easier time meeting the standards that are necessary to limit speech in a war. But I know of no rule that says that there's different kinds of rules that take place whenever Congress has formally declared war.
Understood. I want to thank all three panelists. Caroline, I'll turn it back over to you.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.